Welcome to Celebrating Whole Health, a program focusing on remembering, reinvigorating, and creating a renaissance of relationship-centered whole person healthcare. Each week, we profile the work of a nurse dedicated to providing compassionate, patient-centered care. I'm your host, Georgiana Donadio, director of the New England School of Whole Health Education in Boston. Today, my guest is Pat Iyer. Pat is a registered public health care nurse with 15 years' experience in home health care. She is a certified Reiki master as well as certified in therapeutic touch, and she's also certified as a med trainer. Pat is the recipient of the 2002 Public Health Nurse Award by the Massachusetts Health Officers Association. Welcome, Pat. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we've been chatting up and meeting in a variety of ways and talking about all kinds of things, and you have a wonderful and just fascinating story and journey in nursing that I'm really pleased that you're willing to bring this and share this with so many nurses. I must start with this wonderful story because you and I were laughing when you were telling me about this. Because your beginnings in nursing is really kind of like, you know, the stuff that made for TV movies are constructed out of. I mean, it's a classic. You said when you were in high school you wanted to be a doctor.
I did.
But you took science courses, but you didn't think you could do it. Now, this is the irony here, people, is that you went into as a second major languages, and you were so smart that you went to BU on a full scholarship. Now, people have to know that to get a full scholarship to BU is quite the accomplishment academically. So the idea that you didn't think you could go into medicine is really quite hilarious, but doesn't that speak to that period of time? So, Pat, take it from there, where you went off to BU to take a degree in languages, and bring us up to speed as to how you got to where you are today.
Well, very interestingly enough, when I was in high school and taking all these science classes and thinking to myself, I really couldn't do this, one of the reasons why I didn't feel I could do it is because I didn't feel like I wanted to do the long haul. Didn't want to go for 10 years to go to school, because what I wanted most of all really was to have a family. So I opted for the language and ended up studying language in high school as well as in college. And while I was in my first year of college, I met a gentleman from India, and he was here going to school, and fell in love. And at the ripe old age of 18, I eloped to India, and I got married. So I was there for 5 months. It was certainly an eye-opening experience. And when I came back home, because of the changes in my status, my marital status, and my, you know, economic status, I lost my scholarship. Couldn't afford to pay to go to Boston University, even way back then, which I think it was 10% of what I ended up paying for my son's education there. But I ended up working at Norwood Hospital in the medical records department, and really loving the hospital environment. I loved to wear uniforms. I loved to, you know, go through medical records. I was intrigued. I felt like I was reading novels in terms of reading about people's surgeries. And so doing what people did way back then, after being married a year, I had a baby, and took courses here and there, and decided that nursing was going to be where I was going to, explore that love for the medical stuff. And it just went to nursing school. After my second child was born, I went to a four-year program. It was an associate's degree program. It was 4 years nights. And, was absolutely thrilled that that's exactly what I ended up doing. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, it's just so interesting to me that back in the day, I mean, you are, you know, in your late 40s, so you're still part of that 10-year generation of women who really didn't know that, you know, there were a lot more choices out there. and getting married and having children was the thing. Usually, women became nurses because that was one of their few choices. You had actually had your sights set on something that was different, but because I think that the girls, the women, the young women today, you know, coming out of high school, they have such an enormous menu of opportunity and of choices that the idea of getting married at 18 today, I mean, what would you say if your daughter came home and said she wanted to be married at 18?
I would certainly allow her to express to me why she thought she did that. But I think what happened is because of all of, you know, of my own experience, and I have to say very honestly, I have absolutely no regrets. There have been times when, you know, I thought, well, you know, I put my self-exploration and my world exploration on hold because I really wanted a family, and I really did want a family. I really did want to have children. So it's that old adage, if I only knew then what I know now.
Right.
But actually, I'm young enough to know it now and young enough to experience it now and, you know, youthful enough to do that.
Right.
So it worked for me.
Well, I want to
share
with
everybody, but it worked for me.
I want to share with the audience. I had the pleasure of meeting you in person, and when you walked in the door, I thought you were in your early 30s, and you have a 27 and 24-year-old child, grown-up people. And I was absolutely amazed, and I make a point of this because it's relevant when we kind of start to talk about your journey in the sense of when people are happy in what they're doing. We were talking to Maureen Spencer the other day last week, and she's a gal here in Boston. We were talking about, you know, aging, the aging process, and how does that not happen to us so vehemently? And one of the things I think is being happy in your work. And today, you know, it's such a joy to speak to you because you love your work. It's clear when you meet you that you love your work. You look like a happy and healthy and totally immersed and engaged human being. And it's wonderful, and it's wonderful that you're doing it in nursing, because as you and I talked about in our many conversations, is that nursing is going through a tough stretch right now. And so as we evolve in this dialogue and in this conversation, I would love for the listener to just know that this is a story of someone who is madly in love with her work and happy and fulfilled. And I think that is a tremendous testimony, not only to you and your attitude, but to the nursing profession and to public health nursing, which we are celebrating today. So let's get back to this wonderful story. You were working in Norwood Hospital, yes?
Mm-hmm, yes.
And
that
then
was
you,
my first job.
Right. And
as a nurse.
And then you decided to go into, I think it was, you kind of veered off into home care after that, yes?
Yes. What happened essentially was what happens many times in hospitals today because of economics, the merging of units. I had worked in Norwood Hospital for about seven or eight years and really worked my way up a career ladder. Ended up going back to school for my bachelor's degree at Regis College and ended up really working my way up the ladder. I started to precept new nurses, precepted students, was assistant, akin to the assistant director of a very busy med-surg floor, when all of a sudden it was like, okay, we have to merge two units. You have the chance of becoming a telemetry nurse, which I really had no interest in cardiac nursing, or to go to pediatrics, a pediatric lifespan unit. So I opted for the second and ended up really loving it, but having really lost the footing in terms of here I dedicated myself to this work and the floor and you know, my own personal growth, and that here what happens to me is I get almost like demoted. And here I am on this other floor, and it was almost like I was a new nurse. And in the meantime, while these things are happening to me, I had a friend who was kind of dragging me along to different energy healing classes and trying to use this information for my own self as in addition to the work I was doing. But I got a phone call from one of the nurses who was the nurse in a program where I had done a clinical rotation in community health. And she called me up and she said, you know, they're going to have they're hiring a new manager, and we don't like her, and I really think that you should apply. So I called. I was open. I called, talked to the hiring person, and said, I think I'm going to try this. So that was my entry into community health, which ended up really being a focus point for the last 12 years, really, of my career.
Right, because one of the notes that I made when we were having our conversation was that you absolutely love community work.
I absolutely love community work. I love nursing. I have no regrets being a nurse. It's been the most dynamic, wonderful career for me as a woman because it enabled me to be available to raise my family and work and grow as a person. And there is just so many things that you can do, and there's just so many things that you can do in community work. You can educate. You can do hands-on nursing. You can go into people's homes. You can consult. I mean, there's just so many venues that you can explore yourself as a nurse. It's just fed me.
It is a wonderful, wonderful profession. And unfortunately, unlike when you were being trained or when my generation was being trained, the nursing environment, the work environment, has changed significantly.
Yes.
And that's probably the biggest the biggest problem facing nursing today is certainly not the practice of nursing or the art of nursing or the science of nursing, but unfortunately the application in the working environment, which is what is causing such an exodus and not producing the kind of graduates that the profession needs and that we as a community needs nurses for our healing and for our care. Now, we're going to take a short break. We're going to take a 2-minute break, but when we come back, let's talk about, I know you got into the energy healing for yourself. That was something you were very interested in. And you went off and got certified as a Reiki master and also in other energy forms. But it ultimately became something that you started to incorporate into your nursing work. So when we come back, Pat, if you would talk to us about, you know, your invitation into energy healing and how you actually were offering this to the community pro bono and how that segued you into teaching as well. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Don't go away.
Children who struggle to learn are like buried treasure. They have a wealth of intelligence locked inside. It just takes the right key to unlock it. A lot of these kids who struggle are smart. They just learn differently. Don't keep this treasure locked away. For free information, visit www.focusonlearning.org. Focusonlearning.org. Or call 1-888-478-MIND. A message from the Advertising Council and the CCLD.
AIDS has created over 14 million orphans worldwide. That's the equivalent of every child under 5 in America, with nobody to watch over them. To help, please go to apathyislethal.org. AIDS is preventable. Apathy is lethal.
Brought to you by the United Nations Foundation and the Ad Council.
AIDS has created over 14 million orphans worldwide. That's the equivalent of every child under 5 in America, with nobody to watch over them. To help, please go to apathyislethal.org. AIDS is preventable. Apathy is lethal.
Brought to you by the United Nations Foundation and the Ad Council.
And we're back at Celebrating Whole Health. This is a program that focuses on reinvigorating, remembering, and celebrating a renaissance of relationship-centered whole person care. I'm your host, Georgiana Donadio. I'm the program director for the New England School of Whole Health Education here in Boston. And today I have the pleasure of talking with Patricia Iyer, who likes to be called Pat, who is a public health nurse and has a wonderful, wonderful resume, as it were, in public health nursing. And we want to get to talk about that with Pat. But Pat, before we go there, if you could just tell us a bit about your background in energy work and all of the work that you've also been doing with Open Doors, which is an educational program here in the Boston area.
Sure. One of the things I want to preface my tale with something that, for good or not, I have always been a person that really has been blessed with opportunities just coming my way. And the good thing about that is that I'm aware of it and I flow with it. And as a result, there have been many opportunities that have come my way over my professional and personal lifetimes that have grown me. And one of them was having the pleasure of my first nursing job when I worked nights on a surgical unit, and I worked with a nurse named Marie, and she was going through a lot of stress and started going to classes on using gems and healing and color and healing and enhancing your environment through color and energy healing. And it was just almost like she wouldn't let it go. Pat, you've got to come to one of these classes with me. You've got to do this with me. You've got to do that with me. So I ended up going along and just loved it. I loved it for myself. I didn't have any intention really of doing the kind of work. I just absolutely found it to be interesting and just expansive and expanding my belief systems. And what ended up happening, which is, of course, again, another step in a journey, is I saw in a magazine, Spirit of Change, which is one of the local holistic magazines in the area, a class advertised for a Reiki class, a Reiki 1 class. And I thought, well, this would be kind of interesting to do. So, and I could get my nurse's contact hours, so I thought, well, that was kind of interesting as well. So I took the program, and trust me, when I tell you, I had no idea where in my life it was going to lead me. That one class that ended up just really expanding my own awareness, but also expanding my world. So I learned the first degree Reiki, and 3 months later I took second degree Reiki, and primarily practiced on myself or my friends or my children, and that was it. And didn't expand my world, my Reiki world, until a friend of mine said to me, I have a friend who opened a store in Braintree. It's called Open Doors, and I really think you two should meet. I think that you'd really like this place, and you should, meet this person. So I went down and I talked to him, and he was telling me that he was looking for people to volunteer. He wanted to offer a healing night once a week so that people could come in and who didn't have funds and didn't have resources, and really at that time, we're talking about 1996, didn't really have the exposure, because most people charge for that kind of service. So he wanted to put that out so people would have an opportunity to experience that. So I was the first energy healer down there to donate my time. I went every Tuesday night and gave 4 mini sessions of Reiki, and I just loved it. It was enhancing me personally and enhancing my presence as at that time I was a nurse manager for an adult day health program. So it really enhanced me. And in doing that kind of work and talking with him, we decided to open up an energy school. So at that point in time, I really tell you, I had no interest in doing this professionally. It was just a gift for me. And I ended up studying to be a Reiki master. I studied for a year. I had a wonderful internship program with a wonderful Reiki master. Her name is Cindy Buffoni down in Massachusetts. And did this for a year and then taught the energy school and have been teaching the Open Door School of Energy Healing since 1997. And it's just been just a gift, an absolute wonderful gift. It just has broadened my exposure to all that there is, all that's out there, all the kind of people learning that anybody can learn how to do any kind of healing work. And it's grown me. It's absolutely grown me.
What's interesting, though, is at the same time, you have been a diehard public health nurse. And I say that because you are just an advocate, complete and utter advocate. I know you love public health nursing. You have been working in it for a very long time in the sense that it is your focus and what you're devoted to. So you're doing very hands-on, very holistic, whole-person public health nursing. And at the same time, you are growing and you are expanding. Now, how do those two come together, Pat? And please tell us about the public health nursing that you're doing, because you do a lot of epidemiological work, and you see a lot of tuberculosis, you see a lot of hepatitis, you do a lot of really in the trenches kind of stuff in public nursing. So if you'd share that with us.
Sure. Well, again, I want to go back to flow, because flow is what got me where I am here now. And I ended up quitting all my nursing jobs and doing the energy healing full time for a year. And it didn't fill me. And I needed a change of pace. I moved to Seattle for a period of time. And while I was out in Seattle, I started doing home care again, visiting nurses, and visited a very diverse population, this very large Asian population, Alaskan, Native American population out in Seattle. So when I moved back to Boston, it was just seemed like a natural mix. I decided that's what I wanted to do. And coincidentally, again, and I hate to say that word, because just the synchronicity of being flowed where you're supposed to go, a position came up in this town here, south of Boston, for a public health nurse. And I applied for it, and I got it. And it was working with very diverse populations, as you had mentioned, doing epidemiology, tuberculosis case management. And it so totally fit, A, with my personality, because it's extremely free-flowing and very autonomous to do this kind of work. It's just very autonomous that you use every single bit of knowledge that you have from every walk of life that you, every class you've taken, every nursing class, every holistic class, you just use it all because you are a resource to these folks in their homes, in their communities, sometimes being the first outside of immigration, because a lot of the folks that I work with are very diverse. They're refugees, immigrants, new to the country, new to the town, and I'm, you know, the first person that they come in contact with. And a lot of, there's a lot of fear there. There's a lot of concern. Here they are coming to a new country to live their life after perhaps years of persecution. And, you know, they have the well-meaning nurse knocking at their door trying to help them cure them of an infectious disease. And it's just like, here's the authorities coming in. So it's using every single bit of what I know in terms of dealing with people. And it's been absolutely a joyful experience.
It's really fascinating, the stories that you were sharing about, you know, what it means, first of all, for people coming into this country, maybe unaware that they are infected, for them to come into a culture where you were saying it's very specific here in the U.S. If you are not accepting a TB protocol, you're going to wind up on a TB ward somewhere. Would you talk about, because I know even, you know, a lot of us in healthcare, we really don't know about the epidemic of TB that's going on, number one. Number two, we don't even know what the protocol is in terms of, you know, that you have to accept a treatment or that you actually are put in a hospital. Could you talk to us about the law and about what the process looks like if you find that you have TB, either bringing it in the country or if you are American and you have TB?
Well, let me talk a few minutes about tuberculosis. First of all, there are two phases of tuberculosis. One is the infection. In other words, you have an exposure and you have a positive TB test. And many people that work in healthcare do convert to a positive TB test just because of their clinical exposure in a hospital setting, or people that work with homeless. There's just a variety of ways that you can have an exposure. But you don't have any symptoms. You know, you're not sick. And, you know, a lot of people go on throughout their lifetime not doing anything about it. And then you have the person that it does multiply in the body and becomes a full-blown case of TB disease, in which case there's a high level, especially if it's TB in the lung, a high level of communicability because it's airborne. So you live with contacts, you cough, you breathe, you sneeze, you sing, and the bacteria gets blown out into the air. And if there's areas where there's not good ventilation, or if you're around people that are immunocompromised, that it spreads, and it spreads very easily and very quickly. So that the state of Massachusetts is just very has very stringent, very strict TB treatment. Recently, they've actually even extended that to really encouraging folks that have a positive TB test with no symptoms to get treated, because as we age And as we become exposed to environmental factors and our immune system wanes, that they see an activation in later years for people that have positive TB tests that have never had symptoms or never been treated.
That's true with so many conditions. As we age and as the immune system becomes compromised, we see so much of it. And unfortunately, if you can believe this, we are going to another break. I mean, time is just flashing by, and this is such a fascinating discussion. Pat, when we come back from our next break, would you continue talking about TB, about especially the problem among people who are experiencing it? You were sharing with me that they're kind of like the modern-day lepers, as it were, and there's a whole profile about TB patients that we're not really aware of. We don't think about it. You know, we're not conscious of what they go through. So when we come back, we're going to take a short break. Please do keep this discussion going about tuberculosis. We'll be right back.
This is Arnold Palmer. Parades, conventions, fun, and friendship. The Shriners have a lot of proud traditions, but none they're more proud of than the Shriners Hospitals for Children. I know, I'm a Shriner. The Shriners provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care to kids, totally without charge. And they combine that with progressive research and innovative teaching programs. There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area. Call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
What do you get when you cross a ballerina with an insomniac? Someone who'll dance the night away. And that's what they're doing at a dance-a-thon put together by dancers and their community coalition to raise money for kids' after-school programs. And what do you get when people bring their groups together? Healthier, drug-free communities, especially for kids. So if you're involved with a group, contact your community coalition at helpyourcommunity.org or 877-KIDS-313. Because you get more when you get together. Brought to you by the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the Ad Council.
And we're back at Celebrating Whole Health. We are talking to Pat Iyer, who is a public health nurse, and Pat is sharing with us her experience in public health nursing, particularly with populations suffering from TB. Pat, before the break, we were talking about the modern-day lepers, we're not really aware. I mean, even those of us who are working every day in healthcare, we're not aware of the mini epidemics of TB that are going on. And you had shared in our conversation earlier about the epidemiologies of the different towns you work in regarding TB and co-infections such as HIV and TB and what have you. Would you give us a mini course here on just what's going on, especially here on the East Coast in the Massachusetts area with TB?
Well, I can give you some statistics. Last year in Massachusetts, there were approximately 277 active cases in Massachusetts of active TB, not the positive TB test I talked about, but actually active TB. And over 70% of those cases were foreign-born. Now, of those 70%, there's the largest proportion of people that I'm talking about in terms of those numbers became activated with their tuberculosis in the first 5 years of living in the U.S. Either they were identified when they came in through immigration, they became ill and sought medical care, or just had, for whatever circumstances, became, you know, activated within the first 5 years. And but also people that live and are born in the U.S. do contract TB. In terms of those people that are American-born, you tend to see them in folks that live in homeless shelters, you know, the Pine Street Inn, those types of places, where it's a congregate setting. In other words, their health practices aren't good, their immune system isn't good, nutrition isn't all that great, and they might have histories of substance abuse, so that weakens the body as well, and they're living all off the streets or living in the same place, and it's shared airspace is how it's spread. People cough around you, you share airspace for a decent amount of time. We're not talking about, you know, having a 15-minute discussion with somebody. We're talking about prolonged sharing of airspace, and that's how people contract it. Or you have healthcare people that contract it in their work setting. You also, the American-born population that you see with tuberculosis are people that are co-infected with HIV. And again, it's not so much that they have a predisposition, it's just because they're immunocompromised. and they cannot fight off. If they're around somebody, even for a shorter length of time, that is coughing with the TB, then it gives them a greater potential for contracting the disease. In terms of the foreign-born, again, culturally, people live closer together in other countries. You know, you have extended families all living in under one roof, or if a person has lived as a refugee in a camp, or even if they haven't, I mean, the fact that people have their extended family all under one roof. And I think I was talking to you about some of the cases that I had been with, and a couple of the cases where I went to visit the folks in the home, there were 18 people living in a house. You know, that's a lot of people.
It is phenomenal. You know, we think about, I know that, you know, we have these images. They have these images of third world hovels where people are, you know, living, 18 people living in one room. But you're talking about right here, right now, USA, in the, you know, kind of sophisticated East Coast area here, of people living in this condition.
But they wouldn't, and they're not necessarily hovels. I mean, they're nice homes. Nice community homes. The folks that have sponsored, the family members that have sponsored those individuals to come from wherever, you know, they have established themselves here. They have nice homes. And you have 15, 18 people living in a house, and it's second nature. I mean, they do that where they come from. They wouldn't think of living any other way. You know, they say to you, you only live with your family, your spouse or your children or your partner or whatever. It's like we have our multi-generational, from the great-grandchild to the great-grandparent, all in one home. One particular home was very interesting. The ex-wife was living there with the family.
Wow.
To raise the children. It was a community. It's a mini community.
Yes.
But with mini communities and with globalization, that's where we see a lot of, exposure to these communicable diseases.
That was one of the joys that you shared so enthusiastically with me about how you're able to go into people's homes and all of the cultural misconceptions. You know, we all have them, and so many of the things that you maybe walked into your early experiences with, you know, has enriched you so much because you've learned so much about culture and about family and about the global community. And isn't that wonderful about public health nursing, that you have an opportunity to take a look at different choices and different values and different ways that people choose to live their lives?
Yes, many of us, you know, public health nurses, and we have a very strong association in Massachusetts and with very strong regional representation as well. One of the things that in some ways we see ourselves as the stewards of the community, that we're the first person that many folks that come into the country come in contact with. So it can make or break their experience of America. You know, here I am with my deputy badge saying, I'm the TB nurse and you have to do what I say. Or it's like, okay, I got a case. I need to know what culture they're from, where they come from, so I don't make any faux pas when I'm going into their house. You know, do I need to remove my shoes? Do you don't look people in the eye? Do you not shake hands? What's the impact going to be if I call them and I walk into their home with a mask on because they're still contagious? You have to look at all, it's holistic. It's very, very holistic outside of even the holism of the body, body, mind, and spirit. It's culture, it's religion. One of my favorite experiences was I had a lady that I was working with for about 8 or 9 months, and when I have a patient, it's a long-term relationship that I see them at the beginning of treatment until the end of treatment when they're all done with their treatment. So it's an ongoing relationship. And, you know, very oftentimes going into the home, and if there's concern about the case and communicability, then I might find myself going into the home and monitoring their medication intake for daily just to watch them take their meds. And this lady had a toothache. And, you know, couldn't go to the dentist because she was still communicable. She wouldn't have any, no one could go near her mouth because if she coughed, that she could, she was contagious. So she looked up all her old remedies, and she was a, you know, woman around my own age, looked up all her own remedies and sent her daughter to the Asian store and made this soup and it got rid of her toothache. And she would share her home remedies with me, you know, what she was doing for a pain in the neck or this and that, and all her little home remedies, she'd bring them out. So I got an education, you know, about Eastern medicine, you know, Eastern medicine even outside of acupuncture, outside of the things that we know, that these were passed down in their family.
I know, isn't it wonderful? Thank you for mentioning that. I want to share something with you that, and I think the audience will find of interest. For many years, I'm from New York City, and I did my internship in New York City, and I worked down there for a number of years before I came here. And, you know, people tell you all of their different remedies, you know, the folk remedies that people share with you. Well, when I came, I had heard a few of them, and when I came up here, you know, this was Boston, a whole new city, although they were still very much the same cultural groups that you see. I continued to hear the same folk remedies up here in Boston as I did down there in New York. And there's this one remedy that has haunted me for 30 years of practice. And it has to do with golden raisins, gin, and arthritis. It's gotten to the point, really, this is true, that now when I see patients who have these, you know, irritractable arthritic pains, and they've taken all kinds of the medications, and, you know, they've been through the mill, I've got this recipe typed up for golden raisins and gin and what you do. And there are people all of every walk of life. I'm talking, you know, joggers, people who are athletes, executives, tennis players, students, who are taking these fermented raisins in gin magically, there's some kind of metabolic process that goes on between the raisin and the gin that produces this wonderful effect on the joints. So tell us some of the remedies that you've heard. I'm sure you've heard some doozies.
Well, they're not even doozies. I mean, they're very practical. I mean, a phenomenon that some acupuncturists use, actually, because I've had acupuncture myself, that spooning, and that they will take a spoon, the blunt end of a spoon, and rub it against an area where there's pain to eliminate stuck energy. And the belief is behind that when you eliminate stuck energy from the body, that the symptoms go away. Aha! You know, it beats taking Advil, I suppose. But it worked for her.
So now, how does that work, Pat? In other words, if we're visualizing this, you're talking about the handle of the spoon or
end of the spoon, the rounded part of the spoon, but rubbing it against the body. Because I went to visit her, and she's covered with bruises. And, of course, you know, what we do, the Western nurse thing, oh, no, domestic violence, some situation is going on. And it was a very loving home. It wasn't like that. So I said, what happened to you? And she says, oh, this is what we do in my country. And she demonstrated how she just rubbed the spoon up and down, or she had her daughter do it up and down her shoulder area where she was having some arthritic pain, and, you know, felt better. It freed up the stuck energy. Well, that's what we learn in energy healing. What do? You free up stuck energy, and, of course, in a very different way, but you certainly, the premise is the same, that you free up stuck energy in order to affect change.
Now, you have just laid out the perfect synopsis for one of those television programs like, P.D. Blue, where where somebody gets in a lot of trouble for what looks like, you know, domestic abuse, and it turns out to be, you know, a cultural medical treatment. Because, yes, we've all seen that, haven't we? I mean, that is a fascinating thing about, I think, the work that you do is that, wow, doesn't it open up your eyes about the global vastness of, you know, how we are, who we are, what we are as human beings, and the relationship. It points up how we're all similar, but it also points up how we're very different. What are some of the most, you know, unique differences and some of the most startling similarities that you've seen in your public nursing between how we all are as human beings?
I think that, well, how do I phrase it? I think that in many ways that people in our culture and people in other cultures are almost in awe of each other. And what the fear, the prejudices come really from a lack of understanding of each other. That somehow, you know, we don't want the same things. We have different values. That, you know, even in terms of working in a public health office, in terms of how that has a very diverse population in the community where people have lived there, your traditional Americans have lived there for 30 years, and having a community try to adapt to all of a sudden, we're living in a town where 45 different languages are spoken. My town was recently profiled on Chronicle, which is a local television program, about being one of the most diverse cultures in Massachusetts.
Is that Randolph?
Yes,
yeah.
Randolph. And that how people coexist. And when you drive through that town, you know, there's not pockets, like, you know, there's the Chinese area and the Vietnamese. The people all live in communities together. It is so heterogeneous. So you don't see that they have many ways overcome a lot of that pocketing, like, you know, different
Boston. Well, we see that in Boston, Pat. I mean, Boston is so pocketed and so definitely, you know, have these little boroughs of cultures, which I'm sure had its very strong purpose and a very, you know, significant necessity at some point in time. But I think the story of Randolph, and if we can just congratulate Randolph a bit, because it's a wonderful, wonderful town, and just, as you said, so homogenous, and I didn't know there are 40, did you say
45 different languages spoken. Yes.
That is,
and we're talking about dialects. There's a lot of people from African origin, Haitian, Vietnamese, Chinese, you know, Latino, and it's a very diverse town. I mean, it makes my job extremely interesting and fun. One of the things, before I forget, that I wanted to put out there as resources for anybody that might be listening and interested in cultural nursing, cross-cultural nursing, there's a wonderful book called The Spirit Catches You When You Fall Down. And it's a story about a baby that was born in California with a seizure disorder. And the family didn't speak English and didn't want to give her medicines because in their culture, when a person has a seizure disorder, the spirit catches you and you fall down. And it just talks about how Western medicine and Eastern medicine had to work together in belief systems around trying to help this poor child who had a devastating seizure disorder. So I would recommend that, and also another wonderful book called The Middle of Everywhere by Mary Pfeiffer. And it talks about how we Americans have to be stewards of our community in welcoming people instead of being fearful or resentful of people that come in from other countries, especially in refugee status, and realize that we can make all the difference in the world, and having them change their own view and belief systems about, you know, living here.
Well, you're not going to believe this. I find this conversation so fascinating that we are now 3 minutes past our last break time.
Sorry.
Oh, it's just wonderful, Pat. It's such a joy to hear you speak about this wonderful, wonderful work that you do. And unfortunately, we do have to take another 2 minutes, but we're going to come back, and when we come back, we're going to do some more talking. Let's talk a little bit more, because I'm sure that there are nurses out there and healthcare providers. I know I wasn't aware myself even about how much hepatitis B and C, how the epidemiology of that, which is very intriguing in terms of the, you know, the co-infections and how frequently that is being seen and unfortunately treated here. So we'll be back in 2 minutes. Don't go away.
Hello?
Hello, Mrs. Stewart. I'm calling about your gas bill.
Yeah, I know. I'm late.
Mrs. Stewart, we need to receive some money in the next week.
I understand. I do. I'm working two jobs and doing everything I can. I mean...
Let's get a glass of water, Mommy.
Oh, I'll be there in a minute, Lisa.
Mrs. Stewart?
I'm really trying here. It's just that things are a little difficult right now.
Mommy, the water got on my picture.
Okay, honey, okay.
Do you have our address, Mrs. Stewart?
Yes, I do.
Heat or food? 1 in 5 American children faces hunger because of decisions like this. To help, call 1-800-FEED-KIDS or visit feedingchildrenbetter.org. Hunger, a choice no one should have to make. A public service message brought to you by America's Second Harvest, Feeding Children Better, and the Ad Council.
Welcome to Flight 38.
How you doing?
Oh, I'm sorry, you can't sit there.
Isn't it open seating?
This is the whites only section.
Whites only?
Mm-hmm. You'll need to move back to the colored section.
Ma'am, I'm a vice president of
major... Sir, please move back and we'll be on our way.
Fine.
Imagine what America would be like today if Martin Luther King never had a dream. To learn about the Martin Luther King National Memorial Project in Washington, D.C., visit buildthedream.org. A public service message from the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Foundation and the Ad Council.
And we're back with Pat Iyer, who is a public health nurse. We're having a fascinating conversation about what it means to be in public health and the global experience that Pat has had with the work that she does. Pat, so many things we have to talk about. We've only got about 10, 11 minutes left to our entire show. Mm-hmm. And before you leave, we are going to ask you for some email addresses and phone numbers where people can reach you. But let's talk about, I know I have a few children in the school system here, and over the last 5 years, we've noticed a significant increase in the requirement for hepatitis immunization in school-aged children. Would you talk to that? Because one would not imagine that this was becoming a bigger problem. You would think with all of the immunization that this would have become, you know, somewhat of a smaller problem, but indeed it seems to be growing. Can you speak to that?
Sure. First of all, the push to immunize children has more to do with eliminating globally, and that's what a lot of the the goals are with the CDC and the World Health Organization, is to eliminate on a global level particular diseases that are communicable. And they have done that, that they had eliminated smallpox globally as a result of mass immunization, that they had eliminated, they're close to eliminating polio on a global level because of immunization. Well, hepatitis B, it's a bloodborne disease. It affects the liver, and what happens is it has it's fairly easy to contract, because it's actually easier to contract than HIV, because the virus lives for a decent amount of time in dried blood, as opposed to say HIV, that when it comes in contact with the air, it's not as viable. So the concern is for people being exposed to blood and body fluids to have protection, especially that's actually the immunization promoted for healthcare workers has greatly reduced the amount of hepatitis B for healthcare workers in terms of the contracted people being contracted, and that was actually put forth through OSHA. That developing the bloodborne standards so that people who work in healthcare would have a decreased opportunity for exposure. But anyway, with globalization and people coming from other countries and the possibilities for contracting hepatitis B, it has increased as well. I see a lot of hepatitis B in my community. And, when it's explained to me from physicians that treat these folks is that, you know, you have to realize they're in a country where the same syringe was used to draw blood or immunize somebody. You know, hundreds of people. And that's wow. How it's passed to passed to passed. Or if they've contracted it through childbirth from their mom, mm-hmm. and they're totally asymptomatic.
Don't we take for granted that people all over the world are experiencing the same kind of sterilization that we are? And isn't it remarkable when you think of Louis Pasteur, you think of this poor man who, you know, came up with the, you know, through however he was inspired to know this, he identified what's going on, you know, with puerperal fever and infection and all this other stuff. And yet we think that, we know that stuff now. And yet in other parts of the world, they're really not up to speed with that.
They're really not up to speed. I have a colleague who is one of my TB colleagues. She works for the State Department of Public Health, and she recently went on a trip with the Doctors Without Borders to Ecuador to participate in they were doing cleft palate, I think, and cleft lip surgeries on children in Ecuador. And she hadn't worked in a recovery room for, you know, who knows how long. I mean, she's been a public health nurse for a very long time. And just the sterilization, she said to me, you just had to look the other way. Because, you know, the gloves and just all kinds of body fluids being thrown down a sink, you know, with the metal bedpans, and she just said you just had to look the other way, and you know, keep as much of a sterile field that you can when you're working in this environment. But that goes the same thing in terms of community health. You know, you can go in with the best of intentions as a visiting nurse and do a treatment on somebody, but their house can be, like, horrific to walk into, and you have to just do your best to keep things clean so that they don't get an infection. I certainly have gone into some homes myself where it's like, oh, my goodness. You know, you want to run into the shower after you get out of there.
Wow, and I'm sure that for those people, that there's nothing in their mind that's necessarily inappropriate with that. That may just be the environment that they're used to being with.
Well, when I was discussing one of my TB cases with this woman, and because, as I said, she's my TB colleague at the state, I was telling her about a situation that I have a patient now that there's 7 people living in the house, and it's a really, really horrible. I mean, it's really dirty. It's really horrible. There's food refuse everywhere, and she's right. She said to me, "You know what? You got to remember, it's better than where they came from."
Yes. Well, that's an important point. You're not going to believe this, Pat.
We have time to go.
No, it's unbelievable. It was like we just started talking a minute ago. It's 2:05, but we're going to take a 1-minute break. When we come back, we want to talk about the 2 awards you just recently won. We want to get your contact information, and we want to talk to you about what a joy it is to hear your story and for you to share this. And it is so hopeful and uplifting, I think, for those of us in the healthcare profession, especially for nurses who are listening and thinking about, you know, a lot of the stuff that they go through, and realizing that nursing is still one of the most extraordinary and wonderful professions to be in. We're going to take a 1-minute break. We'll be right back.
Hey, you seen Ronnie lately?
No, so?
Well, I hear he's totally buff now.
Ronnie buff?
Totally history buff.
Whoa, here he comes now.
Hey, lovelies. You know, I was just thinking about the founding fathers.
Wow.
Tough call in the 1780s about who gets authority. Shaking new federal government or the established power of the 13 states. Kind of makes you think. Well, gotta go.
Smooth. He is so buff.
So history buff.
Wow, but how?
He's been working out at LOC.gov, Library of Congress website, Whole American Experience in film, photos, music, and fun-filled facts.
Whoa, check out Clarence.
Hey, love to talk, but I gotta go exercise my mind at LOC.gov.
Swoon!
Want to get really history buff? Visit LOC.gov, the Library of Congress website, and find out more about history, America's great national pastime. A public service message brought to you by the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
And we're back with just a few minutes left. We're speaking with Pat Iyer, a public health nurse. Pat, let's talk about the awards that you recently received. In 2002, you were the recipient of the Public Health Nurse Award by the Massachusetts Health Officers Association, and you were also recognized by the Riverside Community Care for your commitment to the organization. You, I believe, are a trainer for staff in medication working with residential programs. You've done so much. Tell us about the awards very quickly, because we want to make sure that we get in your contact information.
Sure. They were both a surprise to me, to tell you the truth. I was just doing what I was doing, and some days, you know, you go to work and you say, I can't believe that I take a check for this because it's so fun. But anyway, my Randolph Board of Health nominated me for a Public Health Nurse Award last year for my commitment to the town of Randolph and what I've done in terms of instituting new programs and working with such a diverse population and just bringing a lot of resources to the town. So that is the award that I received last year from the Massachusetts Health Officers Association. So that was a big honor for me, and it was presented to me by the Commissioner of Public Health in Massachusetts. So it was a big surprise and a great honor. And my second award was from Riverside Community Care. In terms of dedication as an employee, I have worked on and off for that organization for over 12 years and of just a variety of settings, and just my commitment to education and to seeing that staff have the tools that they need in order to do the jobs they do and as a medication and healthcare trainer and as a healthcare consultant for them. I certainly love to share my public health experience with them and seeing their organization grow.
It's been great. We only have a minute. Your email address.
Yes, Pat Iyer, all one word, PATIYER at AOL.com.
If anyone wants to reach you. And
sure.
I just want to, first of all, not only thank you, of course, it's just been wonderful. The time has just gone by so quickly. But you are a perfect example of one person making a difference. You know, so often in our day-to-day life we say, well, what difference can I make? I'm only one person. What can I do? You know, it's just me, against the elements and what have you. But I think that you are truly a wonderful example, and you should be certainly congratulated and applauded, and you have been recognized by organizations for being a light in the darkness and being one person that can bring joy and hope and help and healing to people, because in your heart you have such love for the work that you do and such an appreciation for the people that you serve. So it is a great pleasure and joy, and we thank you for the work that you do on behalf of all of us and on behalf of nursing, because you are truly in the spirit of Florence Nightingale, which is really what nursing is all about. So bless you. Many, many, many blessings on you, Pat, and we hope that you will continue for many, many more years to do the work that you do, and hopefully we'll get to speak to you again.
Thanks so much, Georgina.
Oh, you're very welcome. And audience, come back tomorrow for another program of Celebrating Whole Health. Have a great day.